on Justice Kennedy retiring and us having to, you know, think about what our Supreme Court is going to look like for the next 30, 40 years, I feel inspired. I feel inspired by women from across the country who came here to risk arrest and say we're not going to sit back when this injustice is happening. So the world is pretty messed up.
And that does it for our show. Special thanks to Renee Feltz, Hani Massoud, Sam Alkoff, Laura Gottesdiener, Libby Rainey, Dennis Moynihan, and to our team in New York, Mike Burke, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Sharina Nadura, Nat Needham, and to our crew here in Brownsville, John Lance, Tom Fitzgerald, Dan Teachworth, Kurt Kirkendall, Claudia, and Maria Luisa. Democracy Now! Has job openings for full-time news producer. Check it out at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. We broadcast from the Mexico-Texas border.
Once upon a time, there was a nice house that lived with a family. The house loved the family and took care of them. Mm-hmm. One day, it started to rain and rain. The house wanted to protect the family, but the water got inside and ruined everybody's everythings. The house was so sad, but the family didn't think it could happen. They told the house that they would take better care of her, always.
Protect what matters. Learn more about your flood risk at floodsmart.gov/care.
Camp Henry offers hands-on learning activities in science, technology, engineering, arts, and math to help kids and teens with an early start in these high-demand career paths. The Henry Ford College Telecommunication Program and WHFR will show campers how their favorite actors, cartoon voices, newscasters, and DJs work their magic to bring us the entertainment we love. Registration is now open for the media camp, which runs from July 23rd through the 26th, so go to hscc.edu and click on Camp Henry for more details and for more information about the exciting programs Camp Henry has to offer.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn, featuring local and independent artists.
It's WHFR 89.3, also online at WHFR.FM, Making Waves. I'm Alan Mazurek. Susan McGraw and I are continuing our little summer vacation here from the new WHFR Journal so that we can bring you another very fascinating series of programs that we have found. This one deals with education in America. It's called Degrees of Separation, and it's going to run for the next few weeks in place of the new WHFR Journal. Don't worry, we will be back in due time with a fresh take on the new WHFR Journal. We do hope you'll stick around and enjoy this program. It's a part of our public service to you, our listeners, as we look at education in America on the program Degrees of Separation. Here on WHFR, we're always making waves.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is With Good Reason. Question: should it be school policy to consider things like the housing, food, and health care of students?
Kids don't stop being school kids at the 3 o'clock bell. What happens in classrooms, particularly in terms of instruction, only explains part of the performance puzzle.
And a new study shows young African American boys are at risk of higher expulsion rates, even in preschool.
Essentially losing the opportunity for an educational experience even before they're getting into K-12.
So can it be too early to talk about race?
If you really want to make a difference in a child's life, you have to understand a child's life. And for students of color, race is a part of it.
All this and more today on With Good Reason. First, the news.
Robots the size of blood cells, Earth-like planets outside the solar system.
Science fiction?
No, science faction. Join us, Seth Shostak and
Molly Bentley and
WHFR each Tuesday at noon for Big Picture Science.
Big Picture Science steps back to get the wide-angle view on science and technology from where they've been to where they're headed.
So think big. Big Picture Science. You'll find it here on WHFR.FM every Tuesday at noon.
We're making waves on WHFR 89.3.
Please join WHFR.FM 89.3 for blues music on Highway 61 Friday 2 till 4 p.m. Each week, DJ Kitty Love brings the best in new blues releases in Detroit blues to Henry Ford College Radio, WHFR.
When we talk about inequality in America's schools, we're often looking at things like high school dropout rates. But ask educators where the real battleground is, and they'll tell you equal opportunity starts in the earliest grades, the elementary school classroom. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, the second in our six-part series, Degrees of Separation. Today we talked to the researcher who found that even in a preschool class of 3- and 4-year-olds, African-American boys may be getting unfair treatment. And we explore how the stuff outside of the classroom gets in the way of what's going on inside the classroom. But first, if you've heard the first episode of our series, you know that teaching literacy is pretty much the reason schools got started. By now, we should be pretty good at it, and we are, for some kids. But for other kids, particularly the poorest kids, teachers are struggling to break through. My first guest is Nell Duke, a professor of education at the University of Michigan. She's one of the country's foremost experts on literacy.
So it used to be that we thought there was sort of a magic age at which kids were ready to read. And what we now understand is that literacy emerges really from birth, before birth. So, for example, when children are very young, if they're exposed to people reading, they begin to understand that it's those little marks that people are reading, and they begin to understand that we read from left to right, in English at least, and from top to bottom. And so they're developing these very early understandings. You've probably seen very young children pretend to read. We consider that an important part of emergent literacy. So now we know we build literacy from the very earliest days of children's lives.
How important do you think literacy is in these elementary school years? Why does it matter that kids are taught these skills?
Literacy is important to being a citizen, an active and effective citizen. It's important in almost all workplace contexts. It's important in just navigating daily life. So if you're not reading well, by the end of third grade, you're at higher risk of being incarcerated. You're at higher risk of early death. You are much more likely to drop out of school. And so these are the kinds of things that make us feel like we really need to work hard at developing literacy in the elementary years.
While children blossom at different levels and in different grades and times, is there sort of a rule of thumb as far as what we expect them to be able to understand by the end of first grade?
By the end of first grade, we hope that children are reading conventionally. That is, the way that they're reading would look very familiar to people and look like the way, essentially, that grown-ups read. We want to make sure that they're enjoying reading, that reading
right.
is a task that they turn to for pleasure, to get information. And we, again, want to make sure that we're also developing their writing abilities. So by end of first grade, we'd want them to be able to write a simple story that we could read. It might not be spelled the way grown-ups would spell it, but we would be able to figure out what they were saying, and we'd like them to be able to write some information.
Is there a point at which we actually worry about the child's reading capabilities and writing capabilities? Is there a point at which we think this is not about late blooming or early blooming? This is not adequate.
Yes, and that point is a lot earlier than it used to be. It used to be that we thought, well, you know, let's, as you say, kind of just think of this child as late blooming. Let's give this child some time. Maybe things will come along. What we now understand is that it's much more efficient and much more effective and really less stressful for children if we are able to start earlier in intervening when it looks like acquiring literacy skills might be a challenge. So there's research, for example, by Donna Scanlon and Frank Felitino and colleagues, in which they found that if they intervened with high-quality literacy instruction in kindergarten for kids who were at risk, they could far reduce the number of children who were ever identified as needing special education supports later. So now, very early on, we look for signs that literacy might be a little more difficult for some children to acquire than others, and we provide those children with extra support, not drilling them and, you know, not anything that hopefully would be unpleasant for the child, but really just some extra opportunities to engage with books, some extra opportunities to learn about letters and sounds, and so on.
Are there studies that show us how well we're doing in America when it comes to literacy for young students? Are most kids reading by the end of first grade, for instance?
Yes, the most commonly used study is one that's about a test called the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP, which is administered to fourth graders all around the United States. It's a representative sample, really, of U.S. students. And the National Assessment of Educational Progress at grade four finds that 64% of U.S. fourth graders are not proficient in reading.
Wait a minute. Fourth graders are not proficient.
64%. But it's important to understand that reading there doesn't just mean can they read a list of words. What we're testing in fourth grade is really can they understand complicated passages about informational topics? Can they read a pretty elaborate story? I should note that for African-American students and for Latino students, the percentage of kids who are proficient is much lower.
What do you think accounts for this? This is the money question, right?
Absolutely. So, for example, I did a study a number of years ago in the greater Boston metropolitan area in which I observed in first grade classrooms that were in very high poverty school districts and also in first grade classrooms that were in very wealthy school districts. And what I observed in those two settings was not the same. There were far fewer books available to children in the high poverty school districts, and the books that were available tended to be older books. The number of kids in the classrooms in the high poverty school districts was much higher. So if you looked at it in terms of the number of books available per child, there were huge differences between the high poverty school districts and the wealthy school districts. There were also subtle differences in the ways in which teachers taught in those two settings. So, for example, teachers in the high socioeconomic status or wealthy school districts tended to have more print on the walls and to talk about that print more often. When they had students writing, they more often gave students an opportunity to write for someone other than just the teacher. They integrated reading and writing in content area instruction like science and social studies more often. There were just a wide variety of differences in the education that was offered to children.
If you could wave your wand and fix one aspect of those things you saw that were differences between rich and poor classes, what would the one biggest thing be?
I would absolutely make class sizes more equitable, because class size has a cascading effect on a lot of other factors within the classroom.
So fewer students per teacher.
Fewer students per teacher, or in a more equal number of students per teacher in the different settings.
Right, but parents of wealthy children don't want you to add children in their classrooms.
I am sure that they don't, but I'm also sure that they recognize that there's a fairness issue. If you have 17 kids on average in a class in one school district and 34, 35 kids on average in a classroom in a high poverty school district.
I feel badly for the teachers who do have 30 to 40 children in the class who all need a lot of attention, and those who have it easier with fewer children. It feels like they're being held to different measures.
So teaching a large number of 6- and 7-year-old children is challenging anywhere. But when you have a large number of those children, when you have inadequate physical resources, for example, not enough books, when you haven't received a systematic, high-quality professional development to continue to learn how best to meet those children's needs, You have a really challenging task, and I think it's right to for us to be thinking about everything we could possibly do to support teachers in those settings.
How important do you believe are teacher expectations? How important is it for a teacher to have a high bar set for what she thinks each child can achieve?
The classic study on this is by researchers named Rosenthal and Jacobson. In their study, what they did was they gave whole classes of children tests that they said were tests to determine whether during that year they were likely to engage in academic blooming, that they would somehow really improve academically in that year. And they picked out 20% of the children they tested and told the teachers that those kids had been identified as being likely academic bloomers. And then they tested the children again at the end of the year, and they found that, in fact, the children who had been identified as potential academic bloomers did have higher test scores on average. But here's the interesting thing. Those children were actually selected at random. So the teachers thinking that those children were going to bloom academically actually led to their having higher test scores at the end of the year. And that study has been criticized by some, but there have been a number of studies after that, literally hundreds of studies, and they pretty consistently show that teacher expectations do matter. Now, this is not to say that we should then blame teachers or think that teachers are the reason that we have these gaps. Teachers' expectations reflect society, they reflect culture, they reflect messages that they're getting from administrators and so on. And so it's a much more complex picture than that. But all of us need to reframe our thinking about children of poverty and children of specific racial and ethnic groups to try to recalibrate and to understand the many assets and strengths and potential for learning that this broad range of children bring to the table. Just to give an example, I've been involved in some work on project-based learning in which we have second graders from high poverty schools doing projects in their community as they learn social studies and literacy content. So, for example, in one of our projects, children visit a local park or other public space and they identify needs in the park or public space, you know, things that may be broken or dilapidated and so on, and they write a proposal to a local city government official about improving that park. And then they present their proposal to a councilman or someone in the Parks and Recreation Department. And in many cases, the Parks and Recreation Department or the local city government actually do make improvements to the park based on these second graders' proposals.
Oh.
In our research, we have found that children who experience these kinds of project-based units in second grade score much better than children who experience traditional second grade instruction. And in fact, their test scores begin to look a lot more like the test scores of children we assessed in very wealthy school communities.
Can income level really be this determinative of outcome by the students' reading and literacy success?
Yes, income is an incredibly important variable. In the National Assessment of Educational Progress, looking at those fourth grade reading scores, we see that kids in the top 20% in terms of family socioeconomic status have scores on average that are much, much higher than kids in that bottom 20% in terms of family socioeconomic status. And that gap between the very highest and the very lowest has actually widened over the last decades. And so we have even more disparity by socioeconomic status than we ever have. That's in contrast to race, where the gaps have actually been narrowing.
What do we think that is? Do we think the rich have gotten richer, the poor poorer? Or do we think something else is accounting for why the educational gap is growing?
I rely here heavily on the research of Sean Reardon. And in reading his analysis, it appears that it may be more that the highest socioeconomic status families are investing more and more in their education, spending more and more on education, more so than that things have changed that much for the bottom 20%. Certainly, it would be hard to believe that the increasing income inequality in our country is not reflected to some degree in these scores.
Nell Duke is a professor of education at the University of Michigan. Up next, if literacy is so important to student success, what happens when 20% of your students can't speak English? That's the case for the Arlington Public School District outside Washington, D.C. It's one of the most diverse in the nation and home to students from more than 100 countries speaking more than 90 languages. And frequently, it's the Arlington Public Schools that are left with the task of assimilating new immigrants into American life. But just how hard is it to do that? Associate producer John Last has been speaking with Arlington Public School teachers. He's in the studio with me now. Hi, John.
Hi.
So what have you been learning from the Arlington schools?
Well, I spoke with a fellow named Sam Klein. He's their director of high intensity language training. And what that means is that he's the guy responsible for educating thousands of kids who are still trying to learn English. What he told me is that this process can take a really long time.
It takes about 1 to 2 years to acquire social language. Social language would be the language of the playground. It allows kids to say, can I play? What's up? Is a slide available? Those things. But academic English, which is what students need in order to be successful academically in the classroom, takes 5 to 7 years.
And that's not even the whole story. If these kids arrive here later in life, or if their school has been interrupted, say they've spent some time in a refugee camp, Sam says it can take as long as 7 to 10 years for these kids to learn English. But even if it does take 10 years, it's important that these schools see these kids through to the end.
Certainly, if you move here at the age of 10 and don't learn English, you're not going to be able to function because, you know, outside of a handful of stores in your neighborhood and maybe your religious institution, you're not going to be able to function very much. Even between cultures, just think if there's a group of families from Mongolia living in the neighborhood with a group of families who just moved here from Guatemala, the common language they all have here is English.
So we know we got to teach them English, right? But Sam also says that from the standpoint of integrating new immigrants, it's really important that we get them in elementary school.
There are some critical ages of learning a language due to some changes in the brain. One would be the age of 6. Another would be around adolescence, around 13 years old. And in one of the ways you can recognize this is that kids who learn before puberty tend to often not have an accent when they become adults. Whereas kids who arrive at 16, 17, 18, it's harder to lose their accent when speaking English.
Isn't it interesting that there is an age at which you really can't master the accent?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And it's revealing of the difference between kids who come here later in life and kids who come here when they're really young. But there's an interesting second question in there, which wasn't fully answered, which is what happens in terms of the values that these children hold? When a 16-year-old comes to America, is there a chance that they might not be able to learn American values in the same way that they might never be able to lose their accent?
That must be a real problem for educators.
Well, it's funny. If you ask Sam, what he says is that for most educators, it's not a worry at all.
Yeah, I have never in my career come across anyone who has a fear of students not being integrated into the culture. Children naturally integrate into their surroundings. Children are chameleons. They will change with the environment they're surrounded by. The big difference is there's a lot of encouragement in the United States for people to also maintain their own heritage. Whether they were born here or they've come from another country, we want kids to maintain their home language. We want them to maintain their home culture.
That is what seems like the hardest of all, to have them still feel pride and knowledge of their home culture while embracing American culture and values.
Yeah, it's a really tough balance to strike. And Sam says this has a lot to do with bilingualism coming back into style. We want our kids to be able to speak multiple languages again. But also there's another element to this, which is that multiculturalism has become a real American value. And Sam says, in Arlington at least, they can use multiculturalism to teach these other American values as well.
Most schools in Northern Virginia certainly have something called International Night. It's a night when students come and their cultures are honored. And again, that's teaching to be proud of who you are, proud of where your roots are.
So I thought, okay, you know, that's very nice, right? But What about tougher values like patriotism? Do we still need to get kids to stand up at the start of class and recite the Pledge of Allegiance, for example?
Teaching the Pledge of Allegiance isn't a value, that's an exercise. If you talk about the value of patriotism, that's different. Patriotism comes from being proud of your country. And I think all through the grades, we're teaching kids American history. We're showing the great things that the United States has done in history and in the world. That's something that's throughout the curriculum, and I think that we're constantly teaching.
So I picked patriotism deliberately because it's a pretty obvious example. But I was actually struck talking with Sam about how subtle some of these American values can be. He gave me an example. He told me, think of independence.
You know, one of the main differences between U.S. culture and many other cultures is the whole idea of kids being independent. Starting in kindergarten, when the kids come in, they learn how to hang up their jackets. They learn how to hang up their backpacks and start their routine as soon as they walk in the classroom. You know, some teachers will put work out on the desks ahead of time. Other teachers teach kids as young as, you know, kindergarten, that they come in, they take off their jackets, they go to the box that, you know, says start of day, and they pick up their work and they start working on it right away.
So that's how we teach kids American values. But Sarah, you touched on this earlier. There's this really tough line that kids are asked to observe between maintaining their home culture, on the one hand, and becoming apple pie-loving Americans, on the other. And it turns out that among educators, how we teach Americanness, how we teach values, is becoming a topic of hot debate in and of itself. You know, the question that comes out of all this is, America is this great melting pot, or as Sam would have it, a salad bowl. It's a great mix of many different cultures. So at the end of the day, whose values are we teaching?
And when we get back from the break, we'll take a look at that question. Whose values are we teaching in America's schools, and who gets left out?
Henry Ford College provides a strong foundation for students pursuing a career in education, offering a two-year associate's degree in pre-education as well as pre-secondary and special education. For more information about HFC's pre-education degrees, please call 313-845-6430 or check out the pre-education program guide at hfcc.edu/programs.
Today we decided to walk to school. At the corner, we waited to cross the street. The stoplight counted down. 15, 14,
31, I mean 13.
We took a left on Carroll Garden Street. Loud music was coming from a car. Danny's a smart kid, but he gets so distracted.
There were so many other sounds, I didn't know what to focus on.
Danny, Earth to Danny. Suddenly, he realized he forgot his homework again.
I left my homework on the table.
At the school steps, we hugged goodbye. I really hope he doesn't have another bad day at school today.
When you can see learning and attention issues from their side, you can be on their side. That's why there's Understood.org, a free online resource for the parents of the 1 in 5 kids with learning and attention issues. Get personalized recommendations, practical tips, daily access to experts, and more. Go from misunderstanding to Understood.org. Brought to you by Understood and the Ad Council.
Music has evolved a great deal in the past 300 years. And that's only because of artists who were able to express themselves in ways that the common practice couldn't. Music is art, and great art should seek to change the world. No one knows when the next wave will break, but when it does, you can rest assured you'll hear it on the Space is a Place program. Every Friday evening from 6 until 8 p.m. with me, your host, Tom Wilson, right here on your favorite radio station, 89.3, WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves.
Welcome back to With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. What kinds of things do three-year-olds get into trouble for at school?
Things like being too wiggly, getting out of their chair, but then more serious things like being aggressive, speaking impulsively out of turn and loudly disrupting the class.
That's Jason Downer, the director of the University of Virginia's Center for Advanced Study of Teaching and Learning. Preschool teaches really young kids good and bad behaviors. That's how we prepare them to go to kindergarten. But it turns out the way we've been defining good behavior may be unfair. Jason Downer has completed a new study into how a teacher's race affects their students. Jason, what did you find?
In particular, African-American boys who were in an African-American teacher's classroom were rated as having fewer problem behaviors across the year when compared to being in a classroom with a Caucasian teacher.
Was the difference, as reported by the teacher, very big?
Significant, meaningful. I think it's important to look at that in the context of the fact that the preschool expulsion rate is actually three times what it is in K through 12.
Wait, I didn't know there was a preschool expulsion rate.
Neither did I until a few years ago. It's relevant to the study because boys and African-American children are more likely to be expelled than their peers. And so there's a high rate of children essentially losing the opportunity for an educational experience even before they're getting into K through 12.
What did you and your colleagues make of the results?
We have a couple of thoughts about what might be going on. And so some of that could be that teachers are bringing with them into the classroom beliefs about people, right? Based on their own background and experiences in the family and their neighborhoods. So it's possible that teachers that are sharing some cultural background with their kids are able to have an improved understanding of where those kids are coming from and figuring out how to best meet their needs.
Are there negative consequences to be perceived as a problem child by the teacher?
Oh, absolutely. There's quite a bit of research that suggests that once you receive that identification as the problem kid in the classroom, that others start to think about you that way as well. And certainly it colors the way that teachers might interact with you and the opportunities that are provided to you within that classroom. These early years of school set the stage for student success, K through 12 and beyond. There's been a number of longitudinal studies that show that educational outcomes in particular become very stable at grade 3. And so I think it's critical to understand what's going on early because it is a pattern that is impacting kids from the moment they step foot into a school and continuing to down the road.
Jason Downer is the director of the University of Virginia's Curry School of Education Center for Advanced Study of Teaching and Learning. Downer's work has a new urgency. As of 2014, U.S. public schools are now officially majority-minority. The students are, anyway. White students now make up less than half of the public school population. But the teachers, they're still overwhelmingly white. Bree Peekower is an associate professor of education at Montclair State University. She spent her career working with white educators to build more culturally responsive classrooms. Bree, how are white teachers often failing non-white students?
I think it happens in a variety of ways. White teachers often come into teaching because they love children and they want to make a difference in a child's life. And having not really thought about race very much prior to teaching, they don't realize the implications that race can have on what happens in the classroom.
And what are the consequences of not understanding ways in which they can better relate to and make sure their children relate to the classroom, the environment, and them?
So a lot of white teachers may come in really with an understanding of race as being only at the individual level. You know, I don't make mean comments. I don't tell racist jokes. Therefore, I am not racist. But what they don't realize is that they, as educators, have power over the students in their classroom and in some ways have power over the families that they're serving, because teachers are gatekeepers. Teachers can make decisions about who they're going to refer to gifted and talented and who they're going to refer to special education. Teachers can make decisions about who they're going to send to the principal's office and who they're going to give a timeout to. And research has shown over and over again that these decisions are racialized.
And what are some classic ways that teachers make the wrong decision when they're sending children either to timeouts or discipline or to gifted and talented programs?
One of the issues is known as cultural conflict. And I remember myself, when I was studying to become a teacher, reading an article by someone named Lisa Delpit. She gives an example of commands and how often white middle class people use commands in the form of a question, like, don't you think it's time for bed? Or don't you think it's time for a bath? And white children hear that question and they recognize it as a command. Whereas she used the example of an African-American mom who, if she's asking a question, she asks a question. If she's giving a command, she says, and the example is, boy, get your rusty butt in the tub, right? So right. That is a command. So in the classroom, when a black child then hears, don't you think it's time to put the scissors away? That's not a command. A command is put the scissors down.
Right.
So the child may end up, no, I'm having a great time cutting right now. Why would I want to put the scissors down? This is awesome. And the teacher sees that as the child being rude or disrespectful, and it can escalate into a power struggle when really the difference is the communication style that's getting in the way. White teachers are socialized to see education as something that has worked for them. So oftentimes teachers become teachers because schooling is something that they've been successful in. All of the things that their families did becomes their vision of what parents should do. And so they don't understand the challenges that so many families are facing when it comes to being able to take off work, being able to come to the school, having a telephone, a landline, having a cell phone that's on all the time. All of these things that just seem very normal to a lot of middle-class teachers are not the norm. And so to be a successful white teacher in communities of color, it's really important to move away from deficit thinking and seeing only problems in communities of color and families of color, and really seeing the assets and the strength and resilience of the community that they find themselves in, and not just seeing it as a laundry list of problems.
Jason Downer's research shows that racial inequality exists even at the preschool level. Do you think it's ever too early to talk about race and racial justice?
I do not. Children start noticing race and thinking about race from a very early age. It's really the air that we breathe. So helping them to understand the issues that are all around them really just makes good sense for early education.
But surely at the very preschool level, students are not yet really affected by racial attitudes?
Ask any teacher or parent, the phrase that is said more often than any other phrase from a young child, that's not fair. Young children have a very strong sense of what is fair and what is not fair. They know what's happening.
What are some of the subtle and not so subtle ways in which children may experience a feeling of inequality from their teacher?
Sometimes it's really as subtle as classroom materials. That can be from your classroom library. I know one teacher who did a really wonderful project with her students last year where they analyzed who was represented in the books of their classroom library. So that was a great example because she was able to take the negative fact that her classroom library was not representative of diversity, and she engaged her students in analyzing it themselves and advocating for change.
Right.
Another example that just happened with me recently with a really wonderful and caring biracial teacher who had been struggling around the fact that her students were coloring themselves with lighter crayons, which is a phenomenon we see widely. A lot of students, because of internalized racism and because of white standards of beauty, will choose crayons that are a lighter color than them.
Right.
So this is something that we've been talking about, something she's experienced in her own life as a biracial woman. And I was in her classroom recently, and the students were coloring, and one of the students was coloring himself with a lighter crayon, and she was pointing out to me, see, this is what I was talking about. And so I asked, well, do you have multicultural crayons? And she didn't, and I'm not sure that she even knew that they exist. And this is a teacher who cares deeply about these issues. So a lot of times it's just simply in our resources and in the supplies that we have for students to make the choices as we are countering the images that they have about themselves.
I'm curious. Clearly, it matters that students feel whether they are embraced and their culture is embraced and whether they're treated equitably. Does this also translate into academic success?
It does. There's some research done by Darren Graves. There's a 2014 study that he did that really looked at the way in which schools are places where students are socialized, that schools have climates that can be racially hostile, and that these impact student achievement. So if we're saying that we want to do everything that we can to support students of color and close the achievement gap, we can't ignore race. And there's research that just came out about the difference that Black teachers can make with low-income African-American boys in third through fifth grade. And just having one African-American teacher in those years can increase students' interest in pursuing college by 29%. So, you know, the ways, the challenges of doing this wrong are huge, and the possibilities of doing this right are immense as well.
Do we know how many African-American students are taught by mostly white teachers?
Well, 80% of America's teachers are white. Only 7% of teachers are African-American, 6% are Latino, and then there's a small number of Asian and Native American teachers. So the overwhelming majority of teachers are white, and in public schools, white students are not the majority. This is not representative of the student body.
So would you advocate that only African-American teachers teach African-American students, or is there a way around this where white teachers can be taught ways to be more equitable in the classroom?
I think that all teachers need to be critically conscious of race. There are certainly examples of teachers of color who are also inflicting damage on students of color. It's really a matter of shifting our mindset as educators to realize that this is part of our job. You know, I think if you really want to make a difference in a child's life, you have to understand a child's life. And for students of color, race is a part of it.
Could you give us two or three very positive things that teachers could really focus on to try to turn this around in their own classrooms?
Yes. I did a study with teacher activists, who are people who really are engaged in social justice work inside and outside of their classroom. And I found that teachers who were successful at doing this really focused on three main things. The first was that they had a strong vision of what a socially just education could look like. They knew that part of why they went into teaching was to try to work towards equality. And that was really what drove them to get up every day and get into the classroom and do that work. So that's one. The second thing that they did was that they worked to create liberatory spaces in their classroom. So that really has to do with the kind of relationships they built with their students. And it has a lot to do with the content that they teach, focusing on student issues and student concerns, and learning how to integrate the academics into that. And then the third thing that they did was that they really stood up to issues of oppression collectively. So this might mean joining a local teacher activist group to fight against high-stakes testing. It might mean becoming active in the union. It's this idea that they needed to work inside and outside of the classroom, and that this isn't something that they would take on alone.
Do you think it is possible to do a better job to close the achievement gap in American public schooling?
Well, a lot of us doing social justice work don't think about it as an achievement gap. We think about it as an opportunity gap. And really, we don't want to look at the outcomes without looking at the inputs and the resources that are being provided. And I think that is one of the key shifts in thinking that we need to think about as educators. If the resources are unequal, if students are hungry, if students have drinking fountains that have water laced with lead, these things are all going to have an impact on student outcomes. And so rather than throw our hands up in the air that we have this achievement gap, it's no surprise that we have this achievement gap when we have the opportunity gap that we have.
Bree Peekower is an associate professor of early childhood, elementary, and literacy education at Montclair State University. So, what about the other stuff that determines a child's success or failure? My next guest is Amy Ellen Schwartz. She's an expert in education policy at Syracuse University's Maxwell School. She says when we're trying to make more equal classrooms, we have to be looking at the other stuff as well.
When people talk about funding for education and they talk about what's the most efficient way to deliver services, it's very, very focused on the instructional side and on the classroom side. But there's this other stuff that people talk about as if it doesn't matter. And I think it does. What is the other stuff? It's school lunch, it's school buses, it's school facilities, it's after school, it's all of that stuff that we know and we pay for our own children if we can. I think we have to have all the oars in the water if we're going to get where we want to go. We have to have all these things lined up aimed at making kids productive, successful people. Or we're not going to get there.
So do we have evidence that this other stuff really makes a difference for student success?
We actually know that these other things matter. And perhaps a classic example of this is the song my daughter used to learn at school just prior to standardized testing. The song went, and I'm not going to sing, are you ready for the test? Did you have a good night's rest? Are you ready for the test? And all the kids would sing this. And then the second went, are you ready for the test? Did you have a good breakfast? Are you ready for the test? And you know, why would they do that? Well, because the teachers and the schools knew that their kids' ability to perform on a standardized test, it does reflect what did they learn and their knowledge of the material, but it also reflects these kind of fundamentals. If your stomach is growling, you're not going to be as focused on filling in the bubbles right or doing your calculations right. And if you're falling asleep, you won't be able to pay enough attention. And so I think this is something everybody knows. Question is, what do we do about that? My take is, that's a good question we should be asking. We should be thinking about what are those levers we can pull to affect that. Ignoring it is really not a solution.
So what kinds of levers can we pull? Has there been much research on these fundamentals?
I'm just getting started on some work on looking at school buses. We know virtually nothing about that. How long should a kid get on a bus for? What difference does it make? If a kid goes to a school that's a little bit better than the one near his house, but he has to stay on the bus for 45 minutes, is that a good bargain? I don't know. I mean, you can hear in my voice, I suspect not. We just haven't even looked at these things. You know, many people would argue that You know, recess, downtime is important for kids. Kids can't show up at 9 o'clock in the morning and work straight until 3 o'clock. They need some recess. How long should that be? Are they getting that? What does that look like? I don't know. Laundromats. They put some laundromats in some low-income high schools. Made a big difference in terms of attendance. Where's the nearest library? And do the kids have access to a library after school? Why is the kid not here? Is there a health clinic in the school? Is there a health clinic near the school? Just, I don't know. As I said, it's the other stuff.
Why is this research only starting to be done? Why haven't we been looking at it as part of education policy for decades?
Well, I think, you know, in part it's because of, you know, the kind of garden variety siloing of responsibilities and for different aspects of kids' lives, siloing of activities in the federal government and the grant world. You know, it's schools are about test scores. You know, schools are about instruction. So where would this school lunch kind of work go? Or where would work on the school bus or, I don't know, physical education or the... They kind of got shunted to the side. They're a little bit more health than the health department or NIH rather than USDOE in the health foundations and not the, the education-focused foundation. So, you know, some of it is just that it's a little bit like not my silo. I don't think we should just call this one out because there are plenty of others that are just like this. As I mentioned, I'm doing some work on housing and kids' outcomes and have some new work that shows that housing vouchers have significant positive effects on kids' performance. So these are not aimed at kids. I mean, the reason you give a family a housing voucher is because they're poor and they need help with their housing. But it turns out that there's this, I think, robust positive effect on kids' test scores. We should know this. Why don't we know? Well, a little bit because nobody was looking. People expected, but it was hard to look at. And, you know, I don't want to say people weren't paying attention. That's not fair. It's hard. It's hard work to do, but honest work. So I think, you know, this is true about health as well. You know, if you look on the health side and they ask, you know, what's the link between education and health? Everybody kind of knows it's there. But there's a siloing of the way we organize things on the government side, on the funding side, on the research side. So these things tend to fall a bit in the cracks.
Yeah, but maybe they're falling through the cracks largely because they're expensive. Take free school meal programs, for example. What's the cost of doing something like that? You're making an argument these kinds of reforms are important, but are they cost effective?
You know, there are some interventions, changes, reforms that we've been pursuing and embracing that cost a significant amount of money. And I'd put in there, you know, things like reducing class size and pre-K. These are things that may pay off in the long run, and I'm not... disparaging those, but they're expensive. In contrast, we have things like school lunch and school breakfast. These are potentially fairly low cost compared to alternatives that would yield the same effects. So I don't want to say this is free. I don't want to say it's cheap. It's all a question of, you know, compared to what else. So New York City went to universal free breakfast some years ago. And then over the last, I don't know, dozen years or so, has had some schools adopt universal free meals. You know, collecting money and tracking and is not free. So you want to kind of think about those costs. If you get rid of collecting money, you get rid of the stigma, you'll get better participation. When we did this work on universal free breakfast, you know, one of the reasons, big motivations, is they just weren't collecting that much money in the nickels and dimes that kids were paying. So when you start thinking about how much money it costs to store a bunch of nickels,
and then deliver them to the bank, and you think about what does it cost to collect it and track and monitor, you have to weigh that against the potential benefits for creating a very different environment. And I think universal free breakfast is a real, I think that one's kind of a real no-brainer. I can't say I can show huge positive effects, but you see some positive effects, and I think the cost is relatively low.
Mm-hmm. What about critics who say it's just asking schools to do too much, by asking schools to look not just at educating students, but also feeding them, maybe housing them, giving them the right exercise? Are we asking schools to do too much?
You know, so on the one hand, I'm sympathetic, right? You can't make schools responsible for everything, right? They're not, you know, there's not one-stop shopping for every social support. I'm sympathetic. My mother was a first grade teacher for many years, and I understand that the difficulty of that, and I wouldn't advocate that. But I do think that the schools need to think about all aspects of what they provide, because in the end, it is not, in my view, that the school's job to say, we've got a great classroom. It's not enough. You have to have a good school. You have to have a school that gets the kids to school on time and to show up. It's not enough that it's just in the classroom. And I think the good teachers and the good principals, they know this. They don't want to become social workers. And maybe it means we need more social workers in the schools. But I think, you know, it's everybody knows that no matter how good the math instruction is, if all these other pieces aren't in place, we're not going to get the outcomes we need and we want. So then it's a question of who's responsible for it and who's going to pay for it. And those are legitimate issues. It may not be the teacher. Maybe that's the principal. Maybe it's the school district. Maybe these are partnerships between different municipal organizations. A little bit of a challenge is that in much of the country, school districts and municipalities are separate. Makes this a little complicated. But this would be a place where the federal government could lead, state governments could lead, trying to do this coordination. Part of the, you know, kind of fair treatment here is if you're going to hold the schools accountable for kids' outcomes, then you have to give them the tools for it. Or don't hold, you know, it doesn't work to just keep squeezing the schools, keep squeezing the teachers, when some of what's happening is outside of their control. So you need to kind of have a good match between this so that we make sure that, you know, that the schools have the resources they need to prepare our children to succeed. Kids don't stop being school kids at the 3 o'clock bell.
Amy Ellen Schwartz is the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Chair in Public Affairs at Syracuse University's Maxwell School. In the early grades, the opportunity gap between the students is relatively small. That's why supporting teachers and schools in these early years is so crucial. But what happens to kids as they leave their elementary schools? How does that opportunity gap get larger? In our next episode in the series, we're headed to high school, and we're going to talk about that school-to-prison pipeline you hear so much about. That airs May 27th. This program was funded by a grant to Dr. Oliver Hill at Virginia State University by the National Science Foundation. Major support for With Good Reason is provided by the Shia Khan Foundation, and by the law firm of McGuire Woods. Support also comes from the University of Virginia Health System, pioneering treatments to save lives and preserve brain function for stroke patients, uvahealth.com. With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, Elliot Majerzik, Allison Quantz, Lilia Fukin, and John Last are our associate producers. Jeannie Palin handles listener services. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.
as an 18-year-old, I let my mistakes kind of take over my life. I was 0.5 credits away from completing high school, and I didn't do it.
10 years later, at age 28, Jackie finished her high school diploma.
When I found out that I was pregnant, I know that I had to do something for myself if I wanted to make her a better person and provide a better life for her. My family never stopped pushing for me to be better because they knew what I could become and who I could become as a person. My support team is amazing. The educational director, my sister, and even my 7-year-old daughter has just been more than the support that I could ask for. I've been given an opportunity, and I'm just thankful for it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Camp Henry offers hands-on learning activities in science, technology, engineering, arts, and math to help kids and teens with an early start in these high-demand career paths. The Henry Ford College Telecommunication Program and WHFR will show campers how their favorite actors, cartoon voices, newscasters, and DJs work their magic to bring us the entertainment we love. Registration is now open for the media camp, which runs from July 23rd through the 26th, so go to hscc.edu and click on Camp Henry for more details and for more information about the exciting programs Camp Henry has to offer. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Featuring local and independent artists.
Time.